welcome to the Martian Drive-In Podcast 121. My name is Terry Frost, and this time around, doing two very recent movies. The first one is Blade Runner 2049, starring Baby Goose, Ryan Gosling, and Harrison Ford, of course. And then going to a movie which hasn't even been released in the United States of America at the moment. And that is Thor Ragnarok, starring Chris Hemsworth, Mark Ruffalo, and directed by Taika Waititi. So I'll sit back, I'll get the contact details out of the way, and we can talk about Killing Replicants and The God of Thunder. Okay, so how has everybody been? Things here have been fun. I got back from Sydney and I podcasted about the Sydney trip last week for Paleo Cinema Podcast, and that long, rambling, autobiographical podcast seems to have a good response from people. They really did say kind things and as kind of identify with what I talked about, which was really nice. I wasn't expecting to. It was a bit of a leap of faith. And it paid off, and I'm happy about that. If you haven't listened to that one, it might be worth you doing over at the Paleo Cinema side of things. But I'm quite happy that I did it now. It's really made me feel that I've kind of crossed a bridge a little bit in my life. And going back to Sydney, visiting Mum, visiting the places I used to know well, really gave me, how would I describe it? Gave me the impetus to move on with the next stages of my life, and that's kind of cool. And it's something I recommend for everybody to do when you come to those crossroads. So I did that. Haven't done terribly, terribly much since then, apart from watching movies, oddly enough, and playing computer games. Sally and I did go to another midnight launch for a computer game, actually for two computer games. One of which she is terribly addicted to the franchise, and the other one should be a lot of fun for both of us to play. We went for the midnight launch at EB Games of Assassin's Creed Origins, which is set in ancient Egypt, and that kind of marries two things that Sally really likes a lot, ancient Egypt and the Assassin's Creed franchise. So she's not going to be playing that just yet, and I'll explain why in a moment. The other one is Wolfenstein 2, The New Breed, I think it's called, which is a new Wolfenstein movie set in an alternate universe where the Nazis conquered America, and it's 1962, and people are fighting back. They've actually got an ancient Hitler as one of the characters in the game. So an alternate universe first-person shooter, I'm definitely there for that. I'm up for it. I'm ready to kill Nazis. Apparently there was a right-wing protest about this game because of the anti-Nazi sentiment in it, which shows you the kind of fucked up world we're living in when Nazis think it's okay for people to protest against anti-Nazi computer games. No, fuck you guys is my opinion, because once you or your ideology tries to conquer the world and kill off whole races of human beings on an industrial level and came dishearteningly close to succeeding, you don't get to tell us what computer games we watch. Sorry, you lost that right 75 years ago. Well, more than 75 years ago, whatever it is. So, you know, fuck you Nazis is what I say. Both of my grandfathers fought you and helped beat you. So that gives me the right to say, you guys don't get a say because you lost that right. If you want to kind of buy into an ideology that poisonous, that toxic, that repugnant, that harmful and damaging, then I'm going to disregard your opinion as a personal choice. So there. Anyway, the anti-Nazi rant is completed. The other thing going on at the moment is the survey that the Australian government put out to see whether Australians wanted marriage equality. Yesterday was the last day you could mail off those surveys. About the middle of November, we find out whether Australia is actually going to join the League of Civilized Nations or not, and things are looking good. Australia has an ideology which we've had for a very long time, but which has been very selectively applied, called a fair go. You give everyone a fair go at things, and it's a deeply ingrained cultural trait. And I think it manifests in weird ways. It doesn't manifest sometimes when it should. But in this case, people want to give a fair go to LGBTQIA people. And I think that this survey, which was totally unnecessary because all the polls said 75% of Australians believe in marriage equality, but the government had to pat on the head their extreme right wing. And so this survey was done. So I'll let you know how it went. You'll probably see it in the news wherever you are on this clay and granite planet. Nonetheless, I will let you know how it goes. But things are looking good for the wise and enlightened side of things there. So what have I been watching? Yes, I have been watching things. And it's been kind of cool. There's a free-to-air station, a television station, here in Australia called 7flix, which most of the time shows shit. It shows deep and utter shit most of the time. Now, I have an app on my Xbox which enables me to get terrestrial TV stations, the local free-to-air ones. It's kind of good because I don't have an antenna to pick up free-to-air stations, so I get it all through the internet. And so I watch 7flix. Sometimes I'm up early in the morning. I have a little problem with insomnia at times. I have a slightly greater problem with drinking too many cups of coffee during the day. So at about 3 in the morning, they're showing old George Sanders movies, the Saint series that he did in the 1940s and the Falcon series, which he did at the same time. He made, you know, maybe a dozen of these at least. So I watched A Date with the Falcon and The Saint in London, with George Sanders playing either the Falcon or the Saint, depending on which franchise it was. And they're a bit of fun. They're very kind of low budget. They've got lots of old character actors in them. They have some nice little kind of bits of cleverness to them, and they're a bit of fun to watch. The prints that they have of these films aren't the best quality, but I suppose they get them either cheap or for free and throw them up on the screen there for the insomniacs like me. And I kind of like them. I may well try to find legit copies of these movies, because they're very much 1940s films, but they've got people like Alan Jenkins and other character actors in them. I did see Hans Conried playing a desk clerk in it, in one of them. And so it's interesting just to see who pops up in these films. And they're kind of light and fluffy and a bit of fun. And I do enjoy them. So I kind of watch them now and then. And I think I may well kind of look around eBay and see if I can find some legit copies of those to own and cherish. Then one of the other things I do is I troll through Netflix, trolling in a non-nasty sense, of course. And I found an Australian science fiction film called Other Life, which is really kind of interesting. Fairly low budget, filmed in Perth about a year ago. And it's got a nice premise to it. The premise is that you can record and have very realistic experiences through a kind of biological software. You use an eyedropper to put the software into your eyes, and you can live a year or a day a day at the start of a really interesting experience, like snowboarding in this case, going downhill, spending a whole day snowboarding, and you basically experience the whole lot within a couple of minutes. And the female developer of this software is a few days away from launch of the company and of the software, and her business partner kind of fucks her over, which is something that's not unknown to be done, and she is used as a test case for using this technological innovation as a form of incarceration. So basically, you get your eyedropper in, the software, well, it was almost wetware, I suppose, into the person's eyes, and they experience a year of incarceration. So she does that. She experiences a year of being imprisoned in a small box with food and not too much diversion. And then the plot really takes off. Now, I'm not going to do any spoilers on this one, because I want you to see Other Life. I think it's a good small science fiction film. It does work. Perth's a lovely city for filming in. It really does have sunshine and blue skies and beaches, and everything you need for a nice setting. And it really does work. You really should check that one out. One of the other things that we've been doing is the Final Destination movies came out in a 5-film box set very cheaply here in Australia on Blu-ray. So I picked up a copy. I got it even cheaper than I could get it from the stores by buying it on eBay. A wholesaler on eBay had them for about $5 cheaper, including postage. So I went with it, and Sally and I have been watching them. So we've watched Final Destination 1, 2, and 3 so far. We've got 4 and 5 to watch. And they're fun. They're fun horror movies. The premise, if you're not familiar with it, is that in the first one, a bunch of people, the teenagers, they're going to Paris for a school trip. And one of them has an incredibly vivid premonition that the plane is going to crash and everyone's going to die. So he and a bunch of other people get off the plane. And sure enough, the plane launches off out of JFK and blows up in midair. And these people survived. Unfortunately, death is pissed off with this and decides that it's going to kill them off in imaginative ways in the order in which they should have died on the aeroplane. And the kid, played by Devon Sawa in the first film, who has the premonition, figures this out and figures out who's going to die next. And one of the interesting things about this film, and it is a horror movie, but it's kind of horror movie lightish. There's gore, but it's kind of shock, kind of gore, is working out how exactly someone's going to die. Because the movies are all set up where the person's in a situation where there could be 5 or 6 different things that kill them. It could be the water trickling towards the power point. It could be something rattling on the window. It could be the loose shelf with heavy things on it. And the movies try to basically fake you out by giving you imaginative deaths for these people. And it's a lot of fun for that reason. It really is cleverly done. And yes, it's cruel as fuck, but yes, it does it. The first one set on the aeroplane. The second one isn't set on an aeroplane. It's set in an extremely vivid and nasty multi-car road crash. And the third one's set on a roller coaster. So that goes to show you how imaginative there is. I don't know anything about the fourth and fifth ones. I'm going into them cold. Sally and I have been watching them together, because a lot of times there's not a lot of crossover in the media we watch. And so sitting down each night and watching one of these movies has been a lot of fun. And it's Halloween soon, so, you know, it's a good thing to do. So we've watched 1, 2, and 3 and enjoyed them. And having that kind of sadistic pleasure of working out how the characters are going to die and being surprised and delighted by the unexpected deaths is something that we've been doing. Yes, it's not a better part of our nature, but we've been doing it. The other thing I've seen is Tales of the Crypt Demon Knight from about 20, maybe a bit more than 20 years ago, with Billy Zane, William Sadler, Dick Miller's in it, CCH Pounder. It's got a really good cast of character actors in it. It's kind of, I'm not even going to spoil it. It's a lot of fun. I think it could have gone a little harder than it did in some ways, but I kind of enjoyed watching it. I picked it up for like $5 on Blu-ray, and so I thought, I'm watching these Final Destination movies. I'll intersperse them with Demon Knight. And yes, it's a bit of fun. The gore effects are kind of interesting without being over the top, and Billy Zane makes a fun demon. He seems to be having a lot of fun with the evil role in that one. So that's pretty much it with what I've been watching. Mostly horror, but with a little bit of George Sanders chucked in. And of course, the two movies of which I am about to speak. Blade Runner 2049 and Thor Ragnarok. So I'm going to play the trailer for Blade Runner 2049 now and start talking about it.
Every civilization was built off the back of a disposable workforce but I can only make so many.
Shh.
Happy birthday.
There is an order to things.
That's what we do here. We keep order.
The world is built on a wall that separates kind. Tell either side there's no wall, you bought a war.
You're a cop. I had your job once. I was good at it.
I know.
What do you want?
I want to ask you some questions. The key to the future is finally unearthed. Bring it to me. They know you're here.
I always told you, you're special.
Your story isn't over yet. There's still a page left.
Okay, so Blade Runner 2049, sequel to the 1982 original Blade Runner, directed by Ridley Scott. This one is directed by the director of Arrival, Denis Villeneuve. This one stars Baby Goose, Ryan Gosling. It also has Dave Bautista in it, in a very short piece at the start of the film, but I'll talk more about that in a moment. And it has Harrison Ford, of course, along with Robin Wright. There's an Edward James Olmos cameo in there as well. And a bunch of other actors, some of whom are from Europe, which, of course, Villeneuve being French, it makes a lot of sense and gives the whole thing a little bit of an international feel. And Jared Leto playing Neander Wallace, the bad guy. I actually reviewed this one on the radio this week with Michaela Simpson for the ABC local radio Northern Territory gig that I do. And overall, I kind of thought it through. I liked the movie better than I liked it just after I saw it, which is kind of a weird arc for me to do, because normally I have an immediate reaction to the film and it stays fairly consistent. But the caveats are this, and the first thing I put up on social media about this film after I watched it is, I thought the XBT train to Sydney was slow before I saw Blade Runner 2049. And I got a lot of nice comments about it. Some people agreed with me. Some people disagreed with me. Friend of the podcast, Robert Hood, who's been on the podcast before, we've had a chat about movies, and I want to get Rob back on again, said, people keep saying that, but for me it was near perfect. I didn't even notice the time go by and was riveted by the whole thing. And I haven't felt particular need to watch the prequel short films to get it. Sure, you can make it shorter, but take out a significant amount of it and you end up with something weaker, more ordinary, and more typical of modern SF action films. I need to see it again, and probably again, but it seems to me that everything in it served a meaningful purpose. So that's Rob's opinion on it, and I respect him. I disagree with him, but I respect Rob's opinion on movies a hell of a lot. And thank you for putting that on social media as well. The thing he mentioned about the prequel films are, there are three prequel films. I think they were released on YouTube. One of which fleshes out Dave Bautista's character, Sapper Morton, who I found a very interesting character because I'd seen the prequel thing. And I wanted to see more of the character in the actual movie, because the interesting thing about Dave Bautista is he started out as a wrestler. He, of course, he played Drax in the two Guardians of the Galaxy movies, but he's becoming a character actor, and I really like that, the fact that he's not just playing the muscle, He does have chops as an actor, and he has a certain sensitivity about him. It was reflected in the second Guardians of the Galaxy movie, particularly in the interactions with Mantis. I like that. I like the fact that somebody who could very easily be physically stereotyped is going in another direction with a lot of the stuff he's doing, and all respect to Dave for that. So basically the story, there's a detective, a new Blade Runner in 2049 called Kay, played by Ryan Gosling, who's a replicant. There's no ambiguity about him being a replicant the way there was with Rick Deckard. He works for the police, of course, and his boss is Lieutenant Joshi, played by Robin Wright, who... Robin Wright's got this great career now of playing strong, determined, no-shit women. And this continues that. It's almost verging on stereotyping herself, but I don't think it will because she's too complex an actor for that. But I really like her character in this one. And I like the combination of toughness and reflectiveness that the character shows. Particularly there's a scene with her and Kay, where she's talking about the fact that there weren't replicants when she was a kid, and she talks a little bit about that, so that's kind of cool. Now, apart from her, the female characters get a bit of a short shift on this. The story arc, and I'll go back to the story arc again, there's, like I said, there's a lot to be said about this film. Kay has to finds and kills a replicant Zappa, played by Dave Bautista. As a part of that investigation, he finds that there is a human skeleton buried underneath a dead tree on the protein farm where he meets and kills Zappa. That set of bones is a female replicant because there's a barcode, a serial number written on the bones. The thing they don't know, and this is again a bit of a spoiler, so I'm going to go a little bit spoilery here, but bear with me, you're not going to lose anything from this. That replicant skeleton shows evidence of having given birth to a child, which replicants technically can't do. And this leads Kay on the chase to find what happened to the child, because there's a replicant out there that was actually born rather than decanted. And that then brings me to one of the things I have with the universe. Basically, replicants, and they call them replicants, are simply genetically engineered human beings who are created as adults in artificial wombs. In every sense of human, they have DNA, they have RNA, they are human beings, and as the movie, of course, tells us, they can reproduce. But they're treated like slaves. And the Terrell Corporation in the first movie produced them, and the Wallace Corporation in the new movie, which took over after a whole bunch of shit went down between the first and the second films, produces them now. Why the fuck does this world need replicants? Yes, they're stronger and apparently they're more durable than human beings, which is fair enough. But there are a fuckload of human beings in this world. The cities are crammed with people, cheap if not free labor, if you want it. And yes, if there's... one of the things we know is that in any circumstance where there's a lot of poverty and there's cheap labor, people are going to put themselves in peril to make a living for their families. There are still people cleaning up the Fukushima nuclear plant in Japan, for instance. There are people working in factories making iPhones in China, which are incredibly toxic, dangerous, and in almost slave conditions. This world doesn't need replicants. They set up a world with a certain bunch of circumstances and then throw in this random thing based very, very vaguely on a Philip K. Dick novel. But this world has a surplus of labor. It doesn't need for somebody to come along and create people in a bottle. That's one thing. That's one of the things that pisses me off. And also the whole scene doesn't make sense. There's a scene right at the start, one of the many, 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 many long tracking shots overhead that appear in Blade Runner 2049 of an immense solar farm which stretches to the horizon. Problem with this, and yeah, I've got no problem with solar energy. I've got panels on my roof. I've got 16 solar panels on the roof. This podcast is being generated by solar energy. But the whole place where the solar panels is cloudy and dusty. Now, if there's one thing that really fucks up solar panels, it's heavy cloud and dust. But the movie wanted to put in a whole bunch of enormous solar panels in a solar farm, and they still wanted to have the grey and gloomy thing, so they just did it. But scientifically and logically, it makes absolutely no sense, any more than does the scene where there's an enormous rubbish dump where San Diego used to be, and great big basically sky trucks dumping rubbish in enormous piles in this area. And as we find out, there are a whole bunch of child labourers disassembling computer circuit boards for the precious metals and the other resources that are on them. That's consistent with what we know of what happens in third world countries. But I really don't understand why they're doing it at San Diego. Yes, the sea levels have risen and there's enormous sea walls and all of that kind of thing. But wouldn't it make a lot more sense to do it in the desert? For instance, to dump all that stuff in the desert rather than on the coast, and by doing so, kind of, you know, keeping some of the leaching heavy metal pollution and all the other bits and pieces you get with garbage from going back into the ocean. It's like there was never an environmental protection agency. Maybe this is a Trump future, who knows? But one way or the other, it just struck me as a stupid thing to do. But and the other stupid thing to do, of course, is the path that Kay takes in finding out what's happening with this, of course, inevitably does lead him to Rick Deckard, played by Harrison Ford. And that bit is laughable for a very funny reason. And I'll read you another thing I put on social media, which kind of explains how and why I think there are dumb things in this movie. What I said was, so Rick Deckard lived in Las Vegas for 30 years, watching Elvis and the Liberace holograms, drinking whiskey and eating honey with a dog. And that's basically how the movie is set up. There are beehives, which are the reason why Kay ends up going to what's clearly Las Vegas. There are a whole bunch of beehives set amidst enormous porcelain-like statues of naked women in very suggestive poses. Now, there's a few problems with that. First thing is, when did Las Vegas suddenly become outwardly a porn capital, a porn kingdom, in a sense? All of it, yes, there is legalized prostitution and there's all the other stuff. But the main drag, nobody's going to allow in Las Vegas an enormous 50-foot-high statue of a woman with her legs spread on her hands and knees. It's just not going to happen, but it looked pretty, so they added it to the movie, of course. The other thing is that these beehives with the bees in them, it's not clear, given the fact that there's the way the movie's set up, there are very few animals, and there are even fewer plants in this world. What are the bees eating? Riddle me that. Yes, you could say, well, they're robot bees, blah, 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 but they weren't, they were real bees. And even if they were robot bees, why the fuck do they need beehives? So it was really stupid. So anyway, Kay finds Harrison Ford's Deckard living in a high-rise hotel with plenty of whiskey, some very dodgy and in need of maintenance, holographic nightclub acts. He has a very, very cool jukebox which plays a hologram of Sinatra. I'll give him that. The jukebox works for me, mostly because I like Sinatra and mostly because I like jukeboxes. But there's allusion to Ben Gunn on Treasure Island in the initial thing that Harrison Ford says to Kay. But in general, it's a weird thing. And you think, well, okay, what is he doing? Is he living on MREs for 30 years? How did he stay more or less sane living alone for 30 years, because that just don't happen. So the problem with this, amongst other things, is that the movie is style, but not a lot of substance. It looks very pretty. There are those enormous long tracking shots. There's the synthy score emulating Vangelis' original score for Blade Runner. There's some good dialogue and a couple of good action sequences, but they're spaced out by these enormous, slow tracking and establishing shots where this movie seems to be saying, hey, look at us, look at how pretty we can make things, look at how wonderful, and hey, look, this one's just like in 1982. We're going to have a nice slow zoom down into street level on the mega city that Los Angeles has become, where it's always raining and 90% of the time it's 3 o'clock in the morning. So you get a bit of that going on there. And the universe never held together for me for that reason. It was kind of monotonal. Yes, it has all of the kind of Asian influences, and it had the Atari logo and Pan Am, both extinct companies, in there suggesting that this movie is an alternate universe that split from our universe in about 1982. But as a piece of world building, it really doesn't hold together for me. And I'm an old school science fiction wonk. If somebody's doing world building, I want the world to make sense by its own terms and by what we know of the physical universe. And this one simply doesn't. And the other thing about the Las Vegas thing is that it's covered in a sulfurous fog. Whereas, and you know, Los Angeles is rainy, it's cloudy in San Diego, and Las Vegas is covered in a yellow sulfurous fog. And also the sea levels have risen. But the thing we know of sea level rises is that extreme weather events occur with sea level rises. And so any place is not going to have a perpetual sulfurous fog, unless, of course, Yellowstone National Park exploded and suddenly there are parts of America which resemble Io more than they do anywhere on Earth. The whole reason why the movie in Las Vegas looks like that is because the filmmakers wanted to show us something that looked like that. But from a world-building point of view, it's fucked world-building. As indeed are the existence of replicants in it. The thing is problematic. It's style over substance. Yes, it looks very groovy, and there's a lot of eye candy there, and there's a lot of eye-blowing stuff. The acting, of course, Baby Goose Ryan Gosling thinks that not moving his facial muscles is a way of showing depth. He has one moment of emotion, pretty much, in the film, but the rest of it's not. Now, the interesting thing there is that the character is set up so that each time he does a mission, he has to come back and do an extreme psychological test just to prove that he's a baseline of a personality and he hasn't drifted from that baseline personality, which becomes a problem for him later in the film, but that's it. So what they're doing is Ryan Gosling's acting style is never demonstrative. His facial muscles, they're not paralyzed, I'll be honest with you, they're not paralyzed, but they're underused. One of the best tools that an actor has is rusting in the toolbox of Ryan Gosling. But nonetheless, they use that because they go, okay, well, he's a replicant, he's got to be baseline, so we're going to use Ryan Gosling's normal, passionless face to demonstrate that. So you get that. So you've got Baby Goose on one side, and then you've got Harrison Ford as Deckard, who gets a couple of good lines in and does some of his better acting over the last couple of decades, in fact. But again, Harrison Ford's acting style in the 21st century can best be described as 50 Shades of Grumpy. And he stays consistent with that to a great extent. When I did the radio with Michaela, one of the things I pointed out is that this movie has some similarities with 2001 A Space Odyssey in the fact that there are long, slow parts to it. Kubrick's idea in 2001 was to show that space travel was fucking boring, which of course it isn't. But Kubrick wanted to go against the zeitgeist of the 1960s and 1967, 68 when he was making it, when the space age was in full bloom and astronauts were heroes. So he decided to make a future where space travel was boring as fuck. And I understand why he did that. Kubrick is Kubrick and did things his own way. But I remember, and I mentioned this on the radio too, I saw 2001 about a decade ago in the cinema at the Astor in Melbourne here, the last old school cinema with a single screen in existence in Melbourne. And there was that scene where Dave Bowman has to go and fetch Gary Lockwood's corpse, which has drifted away. So he goes out in the pod and grabs the corpse. And that scene takes forever. And this literally happened. I was sitting in the cinema, up in the gods, at the top of the cinema, and I reached for the remote control to fast forward through the slow bits. When a movie has you reaching for the remote control or longing for a remote control to fast forward through the slow bits, you know that something's wrong. Now, the thing is with Blade Runner, there's incredible cultural baggage with it. Had they not done some of the things they did, the synthy score, the rainy Los Angeles, all the other bits and pieces, the various psychological tests that you give replicants, all that kind of stuff, the evil guy who runs the replicant company, there's a lot of kind of box ticking going on in this film. And that then brings me, of course, to Jared Leto. Now, Jared Leto has acting chops. We all know that. He won an Oscar. But Jared Leto seems to have a singular and intriguing gift for misreading the character as written on the page. Because his Joker was an incredible misstep. It was thuggish and kind of ordinary, and it didn't have that extra level of madness that really typified, and of course Heath Ledger being the benchmark for Jokers. His Joker was more a kind of coked up thug than the Joker as we know and love him. And in this one, his Neander Wallace, who's blind but uses drones as a substitute for sight, he's got some kind of hardware in his head that allow him to see through a whole bunch of little black drones, is boring as fuck. His villain is kind of understated and calm and wears a kimono and talks slowly and says things that are supposed to sound profound, but when you think about them, actually aren't. And as villains go, he's a void where a villain should be. And that's kind of unfortunate. One of the other things I want to mention about the film is the male gaze and the way female characters are treated. This movie has parts of it which are part children of men and part Her, the movie with Joaquin Phoenix and the voice of Scarlett Johansson in it. Because Kay has a software girlfriend called Joy, who's played by a very good French actress called Ana de Armas, who reminded me a little bit about Maria de Medeiros in Pulp Fiction. She's got a little bit of the same vibe about her. And Joy is a software package. She manifests as a hologram, and there's a tracking rail with a projector on it in Kay's flat, so he and Joy can interact. There's also a thing where she can act like they're touching each other. And there's also a portable thing where he can take her with him. He can take her out of the house and take her around with him when he does things, which of course leads to some consequences based on that. But and there's an arc there too. The relationship between Kay and Joy is something that feels like it's anticipating something that's going to be happening in the future. People are talking about sex robots are becoming a thing in the world for reasons best known to the kind of people who like sex robots. But, there's an ickiness to that relationship that I had difficulty overcoming. Then there's the thing of a female character, and even though we're talking software here, the character of Joy is female, and overwhelmingly female. Female character is just being there as kind of to be used by the male characters in a sexual and emotional way. And that's kind of contrasted with Mackenzie Davis's character, Mariette, who's who's a sex worker, who Kay meets on the street and then has a slightly complicated relationship with. Mackenzie Davis was really good in the Black Mirror episode, San Junipero, by the way, fantastically good actor, and really good in this one as well. So we have Mariette. Again, she's a sex worker, but she does have, at certain levels, her own agency. And there's a couple of little bits of line that give her a little bit more than that. And then there's Sylvia Hoax, who plays Love, who is the kind of henchman or henchwoman of Neander Wallace, played by Jared Leto. She's part personal assistant, part Terminator, let's say. And so we see a lot more of her towards the end of the film, where there's a violent climax, which kind of works pretty well, really. But again, she's only there to be at the behest of a man. Then there is another female character, Carla Jury, as Dr. Anna Staline, who has her own agency within the limits of an immune disorder that she has. And that's kind of fine. And she only gets two scenes in the film, but she comes across slightly as a kind of magic pixie woman, because what she does is creates memories for replicants and has a very complicated control to create holographic images of the memory she is trying to create. And yeah, that kind of works okay in the film, but again, the character is fairly lightly sketched, because so much of this film is spent with slow tracking shots of Ryan Gosling going from A to B. Of course, the argument could be made that all over this film, Denis Villeneuve and the writers are trying to portray the dehumanization of people in a technological dystopia, and that could be one aspect of it. But again, a lot of the female characters in this movie are sexualized and with limited amounts of agency. Now, if a woman's sexualized, a female character sexualized and has agency, that's one thing. I mean, I'm in favor of female nudity in cinema, but I kind of like the female characters to have three dimensions to them. I like them to be fleshed out. I like them to have their own lives and their own inner lives, and to not just be there to fail the Bechdel test on several different levels. I don't like that. I think if a kick-ass woman wants to get naked and then kick the shit out of somebody, that's fine, as long as she's doing it for herself and not for some guy. But the sexualization of females in this film can be seen as problematic by some people. I'd be interested to have a chat with some female friends about this, and I probably will at some stage, just to see what they thought about it. In fact, I may put something up on social media for people to have a comment on, and just see where that leads to, because it was one of those things that, yeah, it kind of left, maybe it's a kind of echo of the Harvey Weinstein revelations and all the other ones, the James Toback ones, all the other ones that are slowly coming out, the Trump, the Bill O'Reilly ones, the Roger Ailes ones, all the rest of them, Bill Cosby. Maybe it's a kind of reflection of that kind of world that we're living in. But sexualized females without agency is something that, well, hopefully we're going to see less of in movies. And sexualized females with agency, I have less of a problem with, because I'm visually stimulated by female sexuality and female nudity. I'm wired that way. But again, I don't want to feel bad about that. And I'm in favor of the same being done for naked males and male nudity and sexuality. I think that even-handedness is something that we're really going to have to look at in these things. And rightly so. Human sexuality is as valid a subject matter for movies, even action films like this, as any other. But there are ways of doing it that don't come across as sleazy or repugnant. And I don't think necessarily that this movie succeeds on that level. But just overall with Blade Runner 2049, I wasn't terribly in love with the first one, because I thought it was limited in a number of ways. And I like my film noirs to have a decent femme fatale, and neither of these movies have that. By the way, the other thing is there's an uncanny valley recreation of a character from the first movie in this one, which really doesn't work. I don't think that software recreations of actors and even kind of rejuvenation to a younger age of actors necessarily works very well in prolonged scenes in cinema. We haven't got to the technological level yet of being able to do that successfully. So you've got that in there. The other weird thing is that you've got a little cameo of Edward James Olmos' character from the first movie, Gaff, who was very cool in that one and is an old man in this one, of course, because Edward James Olmos has blown out a number of birthday candles since he made Blade Runner. But his character spoke in a really cool patois of various languages and was really one of the more interesting characters in the first Blade Runner movie, leaving aside the replicants. Nonetheless, in this one, it was just box-ticking to have him in the film, and his character's contribution to the overall plot really didn't move things on all that much, which is a bit of a shame because Edward James Olmos, very fine actor. If you ever get a chance to see him in Zoot Suit, a movie from, I think, the 1970s, definitely do so. But in this one, it was box-ticking of some of the worst sort, as indeed was the recreation of a character from the first film. So, as I said, Blade Runner was never my favourite science fiction movie. I think it bit off more than it could ever chew, and it choked on what it bit off. And I think that to a certain extent, this film is the same thing. It bites off a lot, but the pacing is glacial, and that really doesn't help at all to maintain an audience. The movie is very long. It's 2 hours and 40 minutes or something like that. And there's not 2,040 minutes worth of story and world building in the film. But anyway, I'm going to take a break now. And on a much, much brighter note, I'm going to talk, we're trying not to do spoilers, on Thor Ragnarok, directed by Taika Waititi and starring Chris Hemsworth, Mark Ruffalo, and the usual gang of suspects, including a character who surprised me by stealing scenes outrageously.
Thor, I sense a great change in your future. Destiny has dire plans for you, my friend.
I have dire plans for Destiny.
Hello, the goddess of death has invaded Asgard.
I thought you'd be glad to see me. Asgard is dead. It'll be reborn in my image.
We need to stop her here and now.
To prevent Ragnarok, the end of everything.
So they're putting together a team.
Do you have a better plan?
No.
We're doing it.
Welcome. Voice activation required.
Thor.
Access denied.
God of Thunder.
Prince of Asgard.
Strongest Avenger.
Let me try. Banner.
Welcome, Strongest Avenger.
Oh, what?
I'm not a queen. Or a monster. I'm the goddess of death.
Did you see that?
What were you the god of again?
Sounds like you had a pretty special and intimate relationship with this hammer, and that losing it was almost comparable to losing a loved one.
It's a nice way of putting it.
Okay, so Thor Ragnarok's the latest part of the Marvel Cinematic Universe, and it's a movie that learnt a lot from the Guardians of the Galaxy things. The space movies that the MCU is doing all seem to have a lighter touch because there's so much outrageous stuff going on out there. Of course, this may change with the Avengers Infinity Wars movies, but Guardians of the Galaxy and Thor Ragnarok show us that other planets are a fun place to be, basically, as long as you don't encounter either Cate Blanchett or Kurt Russell. The story's fairly simple. Thor's looking for Infinity Stones and meets Surtur, a demon in Muspelheim, who is the trigger for Ragnarok. If his crown is immersed in the eternal flame beneath the surface of Asgard, it will herald the destruction of Asgard. Thor, after a very interesting little sequence, which is a lot of fun, defeats Surtur and takes the crown away, and finds out, of course, that Loki has been pretending to be Odin and ruling Asgard. So Thor goes to Asgard, and then with the aid of both Loki and Stephen Strange, the Sorcerer Supreme of Earth, played by Benedict Cumberbatch, he finds where Odin is, and this then leads on to Odin's firstborn daughter, Hela, played by Cate Blanchett, deciding that she is going to rule Asgard. And being the goddess of death, this is not in any way a good idea. Hela and Thor fight, and Thor ends up on Sakaar, a junkyard planet, which has a whole bunch of wormholes over it where rubbish just falls from other planets onto it. It's very like San Diego in Blade Runner 2049. And it is ruled by the Grand Master, played outrageously by Jeff Goldblum, who holds gladiatorial contests as a Britain Circus's effort to retain his mastery of the planet. Now, as the trailer does, gives this away fairly blatantly, Thor meets up again with Hulk, who has changed somewhat in the time, and works out a plan to retake Asgard from Hela. I'm not going to go any further into it than that. There are twists and turns and changes to characters, changes to the nature of characters, changes to the physical appearance of characters, and it's a lot of fun. The director, Taika Waititi, who directed What We Do in the Shadows, amongst other things, and is one of the characters as well. He plays Korg, who is a great big rock gladiator who steals every scene he's in. Korg is the character who I liked most in the movie. Even though I do like the talking Hulk, I do like Ruffalo's version of Banner in this one as well. And we get a lot more nuance in Banner and some perils to his future, which come up. And his Hulk and the Hulk and Banner in this one seem a lot more integrated, in the sense that Hulk is the kind of lighter, more emotional side of Bruce Banner. And we definitely see the kind of duality between the two demonstrated very well in this movie. And the sight of a naked Hulk stepping out of a hot tub is to be seen to be believed. It's hilarious. Now, Chris Hemsworth, of course, does a fantastic job. His Thor has evolved over the movies since the first Thor movie, where he was a fish out of water, but he's become more confident in himself, less arrogant. He's grown up, basically. The character has grown up and learned a very self-depreciating humor, and this movie is replete with self-depreciating humor. The humor in Thor Ragnarok is very New Zealand and Australian. It's very Australasian. It's the self-depreciating stuff. It's the playing against expectation stuff. It's the kind of, you know, light-hearted, no worries kind of humor, which works really well and gives this movie a lot more accessibility and a lot more fun than a lot of other films have. And Taika Waititi, doing his first really, really big film, I think does a fantastic job of it. The direction is sharp, the action sharp, unexpected things occur, unexpected people turn up in unexpected roles, and the movie just rolls us along and reminds us that science fiction action movies are meant to be fun. And even though this is partly fantasy, partly science fiction, of course, ultimately, the Marvel Cinematic Universe is more or less a science fictional one, or at least a science fiction / fantasy universe. Korg is the voice you hear at the end of that trailer. They're asking, talking to Thor about how it feels to have lost his hammer, which again is in the trailer. And Taika Waititi did something very interesting. He voices Korg, who's a great big rock, basically he's Igu the Rock Ape with a Māori accent. And he said he bases He based Korg's style and kind of mild manner on Maori bouncers he knew from nightclubs in New Zealand, who spoke very softly but could beat the fuck out of you. So it's interesting how his real-world experience came into this in a very interesting way. And, yeah, I've seen a number of bouncers who are soft-spoken, but you don't want to fuck with them. And that's kind of cool as well. We get a nice grace note with Odin, played by Anthony Hopkins. And Anthony Hopkins gives us just that little bit of gentle gravitas that the role needs. It's not a large part of the film, but I think he bows out of the Marvel Cinematic Universe on a very nice grace note. And I really did like that. Surtur, the fire demon, is another interesting character in there. The motion capture for that was done by Waititi himself, and Clancy Brown did the voice for it, because Clancy Brown's voice is the go-to voice for any great big fire demon in my book, and he works really well in that too. And we get a conclusion to the Surtur part of the story in a way I wasn't expecting. That this movie does do some reverses that I wasn't expecting, and the interesting thing is they do some reveals in the trailer, which is kind of cool, but they hold back some of the really big stuff in interesting ways. In fact, there's one bit in the trailers where the CG is deliberately altered to not give away a plot point, and that really works for me. I think the art of revealing without revealing, kind of like Bruce Lee's fighting without fighting, is something that Marvel does very well in these things. And the lightness of tone is an interesting one to contrast with the Justice League movie, where there are some attempts at humor in the Justice League trailers, but they're not at the same level of humor as the ones for Marvel. I think that it's kind of an afterthought. It's something they stick on rather than something intrinsic to the movie itself. The Justice League stuff has very much a heavier tone than Marvel, and they're fighting their way back from that, but I don't think they've got there at all, unless there's some really good humour in Justice League, which I am seeing next month, that wasn't revealed in the trailers. Then I think they've still got a way to go to do that balance between the serious and the frivolous. And there are some serious moments in this movie. There are a hell of a lot of them, but there are some serious moments in the movie, and Thor's downfall and what happens to some of the minor characters we've seen in the previous Thor movies is a little extreme, but the movie doesn't dwell on that, because ultimately it's very much an entertainment, and I kind of like that as well. I hope we see more of Ruffalo's Hulk. There's a possibility that that relationship is going to change without doing too many spoilers, but I like it. I mean, Mark Ruffalo as an actor is one of those guys who does, I mean, if you have a look at him in things like Spotlight and other movies like that, he's got crazy acting chops. And he's kind of got a slightly Spencer Tracy kind of persona, where there's a base grade humanity and integrity to the characters he tends to play, which ground the performance really, really well. And Hulk wouldn't be the beloved character in the Marvel Cinematic Universe he is without that Mark Ruffalo grounding. Just finding the right actor for that role, I think it's perfect casting. Yes, before that we had Edward Norton, but I can't see Edward Norton bringing to that role what Ruffalo has. And of course, Eric Banner. And I've got a lot of love for Eric Banner's Hulk. For me, it's part of the Marvel Cinematic Universe, even though everyone else says it isn't. Nonetheless, we do get another scene with the Hulk fighting a dog, which happened, of course, in the Ang Lee Eric Banner Hulk, and in fact is one of the best scenes in the Ang Lee Eric Banner Hulk. Hulk fighting the Hulk dogs really worked for me. I think it was bold to do it, and I think it was savage and brutal and marvellous. Nonetheless, that isn't considered canon, so yeah, fuck everybody else, I think it is. So I'm not going to do too much else about Thor Ragnarok because a lot of the people out there haven't seen it yet, and I'm trying my best to respect that. And I'm also going to be talking about it in a week and a half's time on the radio. So I don't want to kind of shoot all of my bullets right now with that movie. All I really say is I think it works really well. I think it's going to make Boku money because once word of mouth gets out, apart from the fact that they're already welded on MCU fans out there in the millions, I think it's the funniest Marvel movie I've seen so far in so many ways. The characters really work. The self-depreciating humor really works for me because it is the humor of my culture, the Australian and New Zealand cultures. We have very similar viewpoints on that kind of thing. I think Taika Waititi is a fantastic director, and I want to see more things for in his future as well. And I think tapping into Chris Hemsworth comic timing is something that they really needed to do with this Hulk, and they do it very, very well. Cate Blanchett's Hela is a slightly one-dimensional villain, but she brings a certain sexy slinkiness about it. The Hela headdress I really like, which I think goes back as far as the Jack Kirby comics back in the 1960s, and that works really well for me. And as usual with the Marvel Cinematic Universe, the production design is marvelous. The set designs are great. The character designs and the character acting works really well. And the mocap for the non-human characters. This is an incredibly entertaining movie and an incredibly fun movie. And I think a lot of people are starting to say, well, I'm a bit jaded with the Marvel Cinematic Universe, but I think this one pulls the rabbit out of the hat, definitely. It's a kind of breathing space before shit gets serious with the Infinity Wars films. And it really does remind us in a lot of ways why we read comics in the first place, which was to get the wow factor and to be entertained and to be taken to a universe away from our own. And this movie definitely does all of those things. So I'm going to leave it there because if I talk more, I'm going to be talking too spoilery. And given the fact that there's a hemisphere that hasn't seen it yet, there's a hemisphere that hasn't seen Hemsworth, I won't go any further with that, but I definitely recommend Thor Ragnarok. I think there are little bits that don't work, and there are a couple of logical inconsistencies in there, but there always are in comics. Comics definitely don't follow the rules of an outside universe very well. Like, how did Thor end up on Sakaar when there are so many planets in the universe? He just did. So there's that kind of thing. I've got to mention Hiddleston's Loki comes across as a lot lighter. They've definitely softened the character because of the popularity of Tom Hiddleston's portrayal of Loki. And I think that that's kind of right, but having a Loki with an edge was something I enjoyed, but we kind of blunt that edge somewhat during this movie. Nonetheless, check it out if you haven't seen it. If you have seen it, you'll know what I say is true. And I'm going to leave it there for the podcast. So thank you again for listening. Thank you to the Patreon subscribers, all of whom should have orgasms every time they have sex and really enjoy their lives, and may all of their puppies lick their noses, all that kind of thing. I'm going to, of course, do the credits at the end of the podcast in the manner of movie credits to honour the Patreon subscribers. And I'm going to be back. I'm going to try to cram in another Paleo Cinema, another Martian Driving podcast during the next week before Sally and I go for our vacation to the land of cannibal inbred monsters, Tasmania, and have a bit of fun down there. So look after yourselves. Keep watching the skies. Keep watching good movies. Keep watching bad movies. Make sure you don't put butter on the popcorn. Well, here's what I suggest. Cajun seasoning, yes, definitely. A nice bit of Cajun seasoning. A light dusting of salt. But, you know, don't go sticky with popcorn is my thing. Don't do sweet popcorn. Don't do buttery popcorn. Go with good, honest, savoury popcorn, and you can't go wrong every time. I'll be back very soon, so take care of yourselves, and I'll see you later.
And here are the credits. Thank you to Tom the Focus Puller, Sarah the Special Effects Technician, Ian the Caterer, Grant the Technicolor Consultant, Claire the Script Doctor, Gary the Prop Master, Morris, our music director, Jan, our dialect coach, Armin, our key grip, Matt, our rattlesnake wrangler, Elaine, our scientific advisor, Julia, our casting director, Chris, the camera operator, Christopher, the gaffer, Miss Jane, the wardrobe mistress, Tansy, our foley artist, Alyssa, our location scout, Mark, our set and unit director, Paul, our special makeup effects director, Tammy, our donut wrangler, Tim, our New York unit director, Rabbi Steve, our spiritual advisor, Steve, our monster effects guy, Dylan, our goat wrangler, Eric, our set security lead, Richard H, the set photographer, Mark D, extra, David L, the extra, Richard C, our transportation co-captain, Carrie L, our Tasmanian consultant, and Kerry C, our accountant. We also have Sally, our continuity girl, and of course the other Sally, who is always helpful and encouraging and wonderful. So thank you very much to all of the Patreon subscribers. You too can be a Patreon subscriber by going to patreon.com/paleocinema and donating as little as $1 per month.